fervor you can scarcely imagine. They pray and fast and sing and dance. I found it to be too much fervor for me. They do practical work, too, like growing food, hauling water, sewing garments and such. But their real work is to study and write. Study and write. The thought filled me with wonder and stirring. How could there be such a place? And are there women among them? I was there, wasn't I? As many women dwell there as men, and they bear the same zeal and purpose. They're even led by a woman, Skepsis, and there's a great reverence for God's female spirit. We pray to her by her Greek name, Sophia. Sophia, the name shimmered in my head. Why had I never prayed to her? Yaltha grew quiet, so quiet I feared she'd lost the desire to go on. Turning, I saw our shadows against the wall, the bent stick of Yaltha's spine, the waves and tangles of my hair spewing like a fountain. I could barely sit still. I wanted her to tell me everything about the women who lived in stone houses on the side of a hill, about the things they studied and wrote. As I gazed at her now, she seemed different to me. She'd lived among them. Finally, she spoke. I spent 8 years with the Therapeuti and tried to embrace their life. They were caring, they didn't judge me. They saved me, but in the end, I was not suited to their life. And you wrote and studied? My job was to tend the herbs and vegetables, but yes, I spent many hours in the library. Mind you, it's nothing like the great library in Alexandria. It's a donkey shed by comparison. But there are treasures in it. Like what? I was bouncing a little on the bed. She patted my leg. All right, all right. There's a copy of Plato's Symposium there. In it, he wrote that his old mentor, Socrates, was taught philosophy by a woman. Her name was Diotima. Seeing my eyes grow wide, she said, and there's a badly stained copy of Epitaphios, written by a female named Aspasia. She was the teacher of Pericles. I've heard of neither of them, I said, pierced to think of my ignorance and awed that such women existed. Oh, but the real treasure is a copy of a hymn, the Exaltation of Inanna. It came to us from Sumeria. This I'd heard of, not the hymn, but Inanna the goddess, queen of heaven, and Yahweh's adversary. Some Jewish women secretly made sacrificial cakes for her. Did you read the Exaltation? I asked. Lady of all the divine powers, resplendent light, righteous woman clothed in radiance, mistress of heaven. You can recite it? Only a small part. It, too, was written by a woman, a priestess. I know because 2 millennia ago she signed her name to it. Enheduanna. We women revered her for her boldness. Why had I never signed my name to what I wrote? I don't know why you would leave such a place as that, I said. If I should be so fortunate as to be banished to the Therapeuti, you couldn't pry me from it. It has its goodness, but also its hardships. One's life is not entirely one's own, but is ruled by the community. Obedience is required, and there's a great deal of fasting. Did you run away? How did you come to be here? Now, where would I have to run to? I'm here with you because Skepsis did not cease in pleading my case to Haran. He's a cruel man and a belligerent ass, but eventually he petitioned the council to let me leave the Therapeuti on the condition I also left Alexandria. They sent me here to your father, who is the youngest of us, and had no choice but to obey his brother. Does father know of these things? Yes, as does your mother, whose first thought upon rising each morning is that I am a thorn in her right side. And I am the thorn in her left, I said with some pride. We were startled by a noise, a scrape of furniture beyond the door. And we drew up in silence and waited, rewarded at last by Shipra settling back into her voluminous snores. Listen to me, Yaltha said, and I knew she was about to divulge the true reason she'd dosed Shipra's drink and come to me in the middle of the night. I wanted to tell her about my vision, how it had visited my dream, Anna, who shines, and hear her affirm the meaning I'd given to it, but that would have to wait. I've been meddling, Yaltha said. I took it as my task to listen at your parents' door. Tomorrow morning they will come to your room and remove the scrolls and inks from your chest. Whatever it contains will be taken and— Burned, I said. Yes. I wasn't surprised, but I felt the crush of it. I forced myself to look over at the chest of cedar in the corner. Inside were my narratives of the matriarchs, of the women and girls of Alexandria, of Asenath, this my small collection of lost stories. It also contained my commentaries on the scriptures, treatises of philosophy, psalms, Greek lessons, the inks I'd mixed, my carefully honed pens, my palette and writing board. They would make ash of all of it. If we are to thwart this, we must make haste, said Yaltha. You must remove the most cherished items from the chest, and I will hide them in my room until we can find a better place for safekeeping. I sprang up, Yaltha trailing behind me with a lamp. I knelt over the chest, the slick of light coming to rest above my head, and lifted out armfuls of scrolls. They clattered across the floor. Sadly, you cannot remove all of them, Yaltha said. It would raise suspicion. Your parents expect to find the chest full. If it's not, they will turn the house over, searching. She produced two goatskin pouches from the girdle inside her robe. Take only the number of scrolls that will fit inside these skins. Her gaze bore down. I suppose I must leave behind my palette and writing board and most of my inks. She kissed my forehead. Hurry. I selected my corpus of lost stories, leaving the rest behind. I arranged them in the pouches, which still carried the faint stink of an animal pen, wedging the 13 scrolls into tight honeycombs inside the bags. Into the last one, I managed to slip 2 vials of ink, 2 reed pens, and 3 sheets of clean papyrus. I wrapped the goatskins in a faded purple robe and tied it with a leather thong. I placed the bundle into Yaltha's arms. Wait, I said. Take my incantation bowl, too. I fear they will find it here. Leaving the red thread in place, I quickly redraped the bowl in flax and added it to the bundle. Yaltha said, I'll hide it in my room, but it may not be safe there very long either. As I'd stuffed my writings into the goat skins, an idea had formed in my mind, one designed to gain me freedom from my room. I tried now to put it into words. Tomorrow, when my parents come, I will behave like a repentant daughter. I will confess I've been disobedient and stubborn. I will plead for forgiveness. I will be like one of those professional mourners who pretend grief and wail at the graves of strangers. She studied me a moment. Take care you don't weep too much. A river of tears will make them wary. A trickle will be believed. I opened the door to be sure Shipra was still asleep and watched Yaltha creep past her with my precious belongings. My aunt had made her freedom. I would make mine. 8. They came late in the morning. They came bearing smugness, stern faces, and a betrothal contract freshly inked. I met them with smudges of twilight beneath my eyes and acts of guile and obsequiousness. I kissed my father's hand. I embraced my mother. I begged them to pardon my defiance, pleading shock and immaturity. I cast down my eyes, willing tears, please come, but I was dry as the desert. Only Satan knows how hard I tried to squeeze them out. I pictured every grief I could think of. Yaltha beaten, battered, and sent away. Nathaniel spreading my legs. A life without inks and pens. The scrolls in the chest becoming a conflagration in the courtyard. And nothing, not a drop. What a failure I should be as a professional mourner. My father lifted the contract and read it to me. I, Nathaniel ben Hananiah of Sepphoris, betroth Anna, daughter of Matthias ben Philip Levius of Alexandria. On the 3rd day of Tishri, and cause us to enter an inchoate marriage according to rabbinic law. I shall pay to her father 2,000 denarii and 200 talents of split dates from the first fruits of my orchard. I pledge to feed, clothe, and shelter her along with her aunt. In exchange, her guardianship shall pass into my hand on the day she is transferred to my house, where she will perform all the duties of wifehood. This contract cannot be broken except by death or by divorce for Anna's blindness, lameness, afflictions of skin, infertility, lack of modesty, disobedience, or other repulsions or displeasures so deemed by myself. She shall enter my house 4 months hence on the 3rd of Shavat. He held the contract out before me so I could witness the words myself. They were followed by Nathaniel's signature in large, brutish letters, as if slashed onto the parchment. Then my father's name in bold imperial slants. Last, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, my father's instrument, his signature so small and cramped I could glimpse the shame of his collusion. "We are waiting to hear you acknowledge your consent," Mother said, cocking her eyebrow, the crook of a warning. I lowered my eyes, clasped my hands to my breast, a small tremble of my chin. There, I was the compliant and docile daughter. "I give it," I said. Then, wondering if they might be inclined to change their minds about the contents of my writing chest, added, "With all my heart." They did not change their minds. Shipra arrived with one of the soldiers who'd escorted us to the market. Mother went to my writing chest and threw back the lid. Her head vacillated back and forth as she took in the contents. "For all the time you spent writing, I should think you would have more to show for it." I felt a twinge of trepidation on the back of my neck. "You will not partake in any more of this nonsense," Mother said. "You are betrothed now. We expect you to put all of this out of your mind." She dropped the lid, a resounding thud. Father ordered the soldier to remove the chest to the courtyard. I watched as he hefted it onto his shoulder. Once again, I tried to summon tears from the dust clefts in my eyelids, but my relief at having salvaged my most ardent work was too great. Mother watched me, lifting her brow once more, this time in curiosity. She was not easily fooled, my mother. After Yaltha had left me the night before, I'd spent the wan hours thinking of where to hide the purple bundle. My scrolls were at risk here in the house under Mother's nose. I'd pictured the caves on the hillsides that surrounded the valley, the places I'd explored with Judas as a girl. For centuries, those caves had been burying places not just for people, but for family valuables and forbidden texts. In order to hide my scrolls in one, though, I would have to secure Father's permission to walk among the hills. It was an unusual request. Beyond the window, the smell of fire and cinder erupted in the courtyard. They came then, tears gurgling up like a springhead. I went and stood before my father. "I am but a girl, but I've wanted to be like you, a great scribe. I wanted you to look on me with pride. I know now I must accept my lot. I've disappointed you, and that is worse to me than a marriage I do not want. I will go willingly to Nathaniel. I beg for only one thing." The tears flowed and I didn't wipe them away. "Allow me to walk outside in the hills. I will take my comfort there and pray to be delivered from my old ways. Lavi can accompany me to keep me safe." I waited. Mother tried to speak, but he waved his hand for silence. "You're a good daughter, Anna. Walk in the hills with my blessing, but only in the mornings, never on the Sabbath, and always in the company of Lavi." "Thank you, Father. Thank you." I couldn't hide my relief and exuberance. As they left, I refused to meet my mother's gaze. 9. The following morning, I waited for Lavi in my room. I'd instructed him to pack goat cheese, almonds, and diluted wine so we could take our breakfast along the way, impressing upon him the importance of leaving early. 1 hour past sunrise, I'd told him. 1 hour. He was late. Since Father had confined my excursions to the mornings, I meant to make the most of them. I'd risen in the dark and dressed hurriedly, a plain coat. No ribbon in my braid or anklet at my foot. I paced. What kept him? Finally, I went in search of him. His room was empty. No sign of him in the upper courtyard. I'd come halfway down the steps into the lower courtyard when I saw him on his knees, scraping soot and cinder from the oven, his dark face white with ash. "What are you doing?" I cried, unable to keep the exasperation from my voice. "I've been waiting for you. We should have left already." He didn't answer, but tensed his eyes and looked toward the doorway beneath the stairs that led to the storeroom. I descended the remaining steps slowly, knowing whom I would find there. Mother smiled with satisfaction. "Your plans will have to be postponed, I'm afraid. I discovered the oven was hazardous with grime." "And it couldn't wait until the afternoon?" "Certainly not," she said. "Besides, I've arranged for you to have a visitor this morning." "Not Nathaniel," Please God, not Nathaniel. You remember Tabitha? Not her, either. Why would you invite her? I've not laid eyes on her in 2 years. She has only recently been betrothed. You have much in common. The daughter of one of my father's underling scribes, Tabitha had made a handful of visits to our house when we were both 12, those too at my mother's instigation. She was female and Jewish, and that was the extent of our similarities. She didn't read or write or care to learn. She liked to steal into my mother's room and rummage among her powders and perfumes. She performed playful dances, pretending to be Eve, sometimes Adam, and once the serpent. She oiled and braided my hair while singing songs. Occasionally, she speculated aloud on the mysteries of the marriage bed. I found all of these things profoundly boring, except her musings on the marriage bed, which were not boring in the least. I'd understood even then that bringing Tabitha into my life was mother's attempt to distract me from my studies and lure me from things unbefitting girls. Clearly, she did not know Tabitha had rouged her nipples with henna and proudly displayed them for me. I glared at my mother. This time, she would use Tabitha to divert me from my morning walks in the hills. While she didn't know my true motive for these excursions, her suspicions seemed aroused. Be careful, I told myself. Tabitha cast her gaze about my room. When I was here last, your bed was covered with scrolls. I remember you read one of them while I wove your hair. I did. Even when I sang, you read. You are very serious. She laughed, not unkindly, and I absorbed her amusement without comment. I resisted telling her that my seriousness had only worsened. We sat on a floor mat in an awkward silence, eating the goat cheese and almonds Lavi had packed for breakfast. I glanced toward the window. The morning was seeping away. So, we are both betrothed now, she said, and chattered on about her betrothed, a man of 21 named Ephraim. I learned more about him than I cared to know. He'd been apprenticed to her father as a palace scribe, and now worked penning documents for a member of Antipas's high council. He had little wealth. He was firm in his demeanor, which didn't sound encouraging, but overall he was infinitely better than who father had come up with for me. I listened with one ear. I did not ask questions about her wedding date or her dowry price. Tell me of your betrothed, she said. I would rather not speak of him. I find him vile. I don't find Ephraim vile, but I do find him ugly. My wish is that he had the face and stature of the soldier who accompanies my father to and from the palace. She giggled. I sighed too heavily. She said, I think you don't like me very much. Her directness caused me to choke on a piece of almond. I coughed so fitfully she leaned forward and pounded my back. I'm sorry, she said. I'm often accused of blurting my thoughts. My father says my mind is weak and my tongue weaker. She looked at me with stricken eyes that began to fill. I placed my hand on her arm. I'm the one who's sorry. I've been rude. I'd planned to walk in the hills this morning, and when you came, I felt diverted. I'd almost said disappointed. She wiped her cheeks with her sleeve, trying to smile. I'm glad you're here, I added, and it was almost true. My remorse had softened me toward her. Sing for me, and I promise not to read. There were no scrolls left in my room to tempt me, but even so, I wanted to hear her. She beamed, and her sweet, high-pitched voice poured through the room as she intoned the song the women sang when they went out to meet the bridegroom before the wedding. Sing, the groom comes soon. Lift your timbrel. Raise your voice. Dance with the rising moon. Let all of creation rejoice. I'd thought Tabitha shallow, but perhaps she wasn't superficial so much as light-hearted. She was a girl, that's all. A playful girl who lifted her timbrel. At that moment, she seemed everything I was not, and this came as a small revelation. I had hated in her what I lacked in myself. You are very serious, she'd told me. Despite the soreness that lingered in my ankle, I pulled her to her feet, joining my voice with hers, and we twirled in circles to the point of dizziness and collapsed onto the floor, laughing. Mother's plot to bring Tabitha back into my life had indeed affected me, though not in the way she'd hoped. I could never be dissuaded from my studies or my walks, but I was far more pleased to sing. 10. Tabitha came often to our house in the mornings, hindering my quest in the hills. I worried constantly that Shipra or Mother would discover my scrolls and my bowl in Yaltha's room, and yet I was happy for my friend's presence. Her visits were bright splotches amid the grimness of anticipating a marriage to Nathaniel. She knew untold songs, most of which she'd composed herself in hexameters and trimeters. There was one about a madwoman who starts laughing and can't stop, another about a peasant who bakes a worm into a loaf of bread and serves it to the tetrarch, and my favorite about a girl who escapes a harem by pretending to be a boy. Even Yaltha would rise earlier than usual from her bed to hear what Tabitha had concocted, bringing an Egyptian rattling musical instrument called a sistrum and shaking it in rhythm with the songs. Tabitha would free her straight black hair from its constraints and, without a trace of shyness, dance out the story as she sang. She had a small, lithe body and a lovely face with high arching brows. Watching her move was like gazing at mesmeric curls of smoke. One morning when Tabitha arrived, she had an amused, conspiratorial look about her. She said, "Today we shall perform a dance together." When I protested, she snorted, "You have no choice. I've written a song that requires both of us." I had never danced, not ever. "What's the song about?" I asked. "We shall be two blind girls who pretend we can see in order to keep our betrotheds." I didn't know if I cared for her song's proposition. Could we be blind and pretend to see in order to keep our tutors? No girl would enact such an elaborate pretense for a tutor. I would. She rolled her eyes upward, but I saw she was more amused than exasperated. "Then you shall pretend that your betrothed is your tutor." There was something strangely beautiful about this, the coming together of two ways of life that I'd thought irreconcilable. Duty and longing. We slipped into Mother's room while she was occupied in the courtyard and lifted the lid on her storage chest, the oak one carved on top with braided circles and fastened with a brass clasp. Tabitha dug out dyed scarves the color of rubies and tied them about our hips. She rummaged among the pouches for a coal stick and drew a pair of staring eyes atop my closed lids. And when it was my turn to draw the same upon hers, I giggled so uncontrollably the stick of coal made a streak across her temple. She said, "We will dance with our eyes closed, completely blind, but we will look as if we can see." At the bottom of the chest, Tabitha found Mother's wooden jewel box. Would we now plunder her jewelry too? I glanced back at the door while Tabitha draped the carnelian necklace about her neck and tied lapis beads about mine. She adorned us with gold and amethyst headbands and pushed gold rings on our fingers. She said, "Just because we're blind doesn't mean we can't look beautiful." Coming upon a vial of perfume, she opened it, and the sharp smell of 1,000 lilies cut the air. Spikenard, the costliest of all the scents. "Not that one," I said. "It's too expensive." "Surely we poor blind girls deserve spikenard." She blinked, and the eyes I'd painted on her lids flashed me an imploring look. I gave in easily, and she placed a drop of the oil on her finger and touched it to my forehead, as mothers did when anointing and naming their babies. "I anoint you Anna, friend of Tabitha," she said, and let out a quiet laugh, making it hard to know whether she was being serious or playful. But then she held my eyes and repeated the words, "Friend of Tabitha." And I realized she was being both. "Now me," she said. I dipped my finger into the vial and touched her forehead. "I anoint you, Tabitha, friend of Anna." And this time she didn't laugh. We repacked the chest as we'd found it and hurried from the room, exhilarated and reeking, leaving behind a great deal of olfactory evidence of our plundering. Yaltha waited for us in my room. She shook the sistrum, setting loose a shimmering sound. Tabitha began to sing, and with a nod at me to follow her lead, sank her eyelids closed and danced. I closed my eyes too, but stood there motionless and inhibited. "You are very serious," I told myself, and then let my arms and legs do as they pleased. I swayed. I was a willow reed, a floating cloud, a raven. I was a blind girl pretending to see. Once I careened into Tabitha, and she found my hand and didn't let go. I didn't think once of Nathaniel. I thought of the young man in the market who'd lifted me to my feet. I thought of scrolls and ink. In the darkness behind my eyes, I was free. 11. On the days Tabitha didn't visit, Lavi and I departed the house early and ventured across Sepphoris to the southern gate of the city, where I would pause to take in the valley, making a ceremony of it, gazing down on clouds and birds, then up at the sharp blue edges, and the wind would blow wild around me. Then I would descend onto the footpath that led across the hills, determined to find a cave to hide my scrolls and incantation bowl. Time pressed on me. Thus far, Mother had failed to search my aunt's room. Perhaps it hadn't yet occurred to her that the two of us were in collusion, but it might, and soon. Each day upon waking, I tore from my room, frantic to find Yalfa and inquire if the bundle was safe. I asked myself why the prospect of losing 13 scrolls, 2 vials of ink, 2 reed pens, 3 clean sheets of papyrus, and a bowl set off such desperation in me. Only now do I see the immensity I assigned to these objects. They not only represented those fragile stories I wanted to preserve, they also held the full weight of my craving to express myself, to lift out of my small self, out of the enclosure of my life, and find what lay beyond. I wanted for so much. The urgency of finding a cave possessed me. Lavi threw himself into the mission, too, though he fretted when I veered from the path. The isolated thickets were populated with badgers, boars, wild goats, hyenas, and jackals. Each time we went out, I wandered farther and farther afield. We came upon men laboring in a limestone quarry, women washing garments in a stream, shepherd boys pretending their crooks were swords, Nazarene girls gathering the late olive harvest. Now and then we passed a pious man praying in a nook of rock or beneath an acacia tree. We found dozens of caves, but none were well suited. They were too accessible, or showed signs of habitation, or had been claimed as a tomb and were sealed with a stone. We walked the hills to no avail. 12. It was rare that Father, Mother, Yalfa, and I shared a meal together other than on the Sabbath, so when Mother insisted we all sit down together, I knew there must be news. Father, however, had taken up the better part of our supper with a tirade about bowls made of gold that were missing from the palace. "But why should you be concerned with it?" Mother asked. "They're the bowls used to serve scribes and subordinates in the library. First one went missing, then 2, now 4. Antipas is angered. He has charged me to find the thief. I cannot see what I'm to do about it. I'm not a palace guard." This could hardly be the reason for our family convocation. "We've had enough of stolen bowls, Matthias," Mother said and stood, ebullient, full of leaven. Ah, here it was. "I have important news, Anna. Your betrothal ceremony will take place at the palace." I stared at a sprinkle of pomegranate seeds strewn on the serving platter. "Did you hear me? Herod Antipas himself will host the betrothal meal. He will act as one of the 2 witnesses, the Tetrarch." "The Tetrarch, Anna, can you imagine?" No, I could not. A betrothal had to be publicly formalized, but did it have to be a spectacle? This bore signs of my mother's scheming. I'd never been inside the palace where my father went each day to give the Tetrarch advice and record his letters and edicts, but Mother had once attended a banquet there with Father, albeit confined to a separate women's meal. It had been followed by weeks of obsessive talk about what she'd seen. Roman baths, monkeys chained in the courtyard, fire dancers, platters of roasted ostrich, and most alluring of all, Herod Antipas's young wife, Phasaelis, a Nabatean princess with a crown of shining black hair that reached the floor. Sitting on her banquet couch, the princess had wrapped locks of her hair about her arms like snakes and entertained the women by undulating her arms. So Mother said. "When will this take place?" I asked. "The 19th of Markeshvan." "But that is only a month away." I know, she said. I cannot think how I'll manage it. She returned to her place beside Father. It falls on me, of course, to purchase gifts for the Tetrarch and Nathaniel's family, and to accumulate your bridal goods. You will need new tunics, coats, and sandals. I'll need to purchase hair ornaments, powders, glassware, pottery. I cannot have you arriving at Nathaniel's house with tattered belongings. On she yattered. I felt myself swept like a twig into a coursing river. I cast a drowning look at Yaltha. 13. One morning, while Tabitha and I nibbled honey cakes, Yaltha entranced us with an Egyptian story, a tale about Osiris, who was murdered and dismembered, then reassembled and resurrected by the goddess Isis. She left out no grisly detail. Tabitha was so awed by the telling, she began to wheeze a little. I nodded at her as if to say, "My aunt knows everything." "Did this really happen?" Tabitha asked. "No, dear," Yaltha said. "It's not meant to be a factual story, but it's still true." "I don't see how," Tabitha said. I wasn't sure I did either. "I mean that the story can happen inside us," Yaltha said. "Think of it. The life you're living can be torn apart like Osiris's and a new one pieced together. Some part of you might die and a new self will rise up to take its place." Tabitha scrunched her face. Yaltha said, "Right now you are a girl in your father's house, but soon that life will die and a new one will be born, that of a wife." She turned her gaze on me. "Do not leave it to fate. You must be the one who does the resurrecting. You must be Isis, recreating Osiris." My aunt nodded at me, and I understood. If my life must be torn apart by this betrothal, then I must try to reassemble it according to my own design. That night I lay on my bed determined to become free of my betrothal by a divorce before the marriage ritual ever occurred. It would be difficult, nearly impossible. A woman couldn't appeal for a divorce unless her husband refused his conjugal duties after marriage, and if he refused those, I would consider myself the most blessed woman in Galilee, perhaps in the entire Roman Empire. Oh, but a man. He could divorce a woman before or after the marriage for practically anything. Nathaniel could divorce me if I went blind or lame or exhibited afflictions of the skin. He could do so for infertility, lack of modesty, disobedience, or other so-called repulsions. Well, I would not go blind or lame for the man, but I would gladly offer up any of the other reasons. If they failed, I would reverse Tabitha's song and be a seeing girl who pretended to be blind. Even such small and ridiculous plots comforted me. It was while slipping over the edge of sleep that a worrisome thought came to me. If I should be so fortunate as to goad Nathaniel to divorce me before the marriage, a second betrothal would be improbable. A divorced woman was more or less unmarriageable. I'd thought this would be a blissful state, but since seeing the young man in the market, I was no longer sure. 14. As Lavi and I traversed the city, sunrise was loitering about the streets, pink light everywhere like little doused flames. I hadn't lost hope of finding a cave to bury my writings, but I was growing impatient. It was our seventh trip into the hills. Catching sight of the palace's glinting white walls and arched red roofs, I came to a stop. A ceremony in the presence of the Tetrarch would bring attention to our betrothal from every corner of Galilee and give it the appearance of a royal sanction. Prodding Nathaniel into a divorce would be even more difficult. I feared I would never rid myself of him. We arrived at the eastern gate of the city. It was called Livia, named for the Roman emperor's wife. Girded with cedar pillars, the gate had recently been slashed with swords and axes. I presumed the zealots had passed through and left evidence of their contempt, and I wondered if Judas had been among them. Tales of Simon ben Gioras and his men had become rampant in the city. Lavi brought stories back from the metalsmith, the grain mill, the winepress, and each time they grew in violence. Two nights previous, I heard Father shout at Mother that if Judas were among the bandits, Antipas would have him executed and he would be unable to stop it. Before descending into the valley, I stood at the Livia gate for a while, watching people below on the road from Nazareth. From this height, the village with its white houses was visible in the distance, no larger than a flock of sheep. The first cave we found showed the unmistakable signs of an animal lair, and we abandoned it quickly. Then, wandering from the path, we strolled into a balsam grove. We walked toward a bright opening where the trees stopped and an outcrop of limestone began. I heard him first, his low, impenetrable chant. Then I saw him, and behind him the dark opening of a cave. The man stood framed in stone, his back to me, hands lifted, droning words. A prayer of some kind. I crept as close as I dared without being seen. On a rock nearby was a leather belt that held an awl, a hammer, a chisel, and some other bowed instrument. His tools. Sunlight sparked on the rock. An auspice. He turned his head slightly, confirming what I knew already. It was the man from the market. Jesus. I lowered myself to the ground, motioning Lavi to do the same. The dirge of his song went on and on. It was the Aramaic Kaddish, the one for mourners. Someone had died. His voice cast a spell of beauty over me. My breath shortened, heat rose along my face and neck, a ripple in my thighs. I wanted to go to him. I wanted to tell him my name and thank him for coming to my aid in the market. I wished to inquire about the injury to his head and if he'd avoided the soldier who'd pursued him. What had he meant to say to me before he was assaulted? Was the woman who used his fingers as sorting pegs his sister? Who had died? I had so many questions, but I dared not disturb his grief or his prayers. Even if he'd been engaged in nothing more than collecting plants for his sister's or wife's dyes, it would have been an indecency to approach him. I glanced past him to the cave. Had God not brought me here? From behind my shoulder, Lavi whispered, "We must leave now." I'd forgotten his presence. I collected my thoughts. This man, Jesus, is a stonemason who walks to Sepphoris from Nazareth. He's devout, coming here to pray before his labors. I looked skyward for the sun, noting the time, then slipped back into the trees, parting the blue shadows. 15. I found Yaltha in her room. She was my ally, my place of mooring, but when I attempted to tell her about Jesus and the longing I'd felt to speak to him, I was seized by an inexplicable diffidence. How could I explain, even to her, the pull I felt toward a complete stranger? Sensing my reserve, she said, "What is it, child?" I found a cave in which to hide my bowl and my writings. "I'm relieved to hear it. It's none too soon. Earlier today I found Shipra rummaging among my things." She looked at the cypress chest she'd brought from Alexandria. Soon after arriving, she'd opened it for me, just as I'd opened my chest for her. Inside had been the sistrum, a beaded headscarf, a pouch of amulets and charms, and a wondrous pair of Egyptian scissors composed of two long bronze blades connected by a metal strip. Had she placed my treasures in the chest? Had Shipra discovered them? I felt a prick of panic, but she quickly retrieved the bundle of my scrolls from beneath a stack of clothing on a tripod stool, hidden in plain view, then withdrew my incantation bowl from beneath her sleeping mat. Taking the bowl from her, I peeled away the flax cloth, spying the red thread still coiled at the bottom, and my limbs went loose. It came to me then. I did know what to say to her about Jesus, but I was too frightened to confess it. The one text Father had forbidden me was the Song of Solomon, a poem of a woman and her lover. Naturally, therefore, I'd sought it out and read it 4 times. I'd read it with the same heat in my face and rippling in my thighs that I'd felt watching Jesus in the clearing. Fragments of the text lodged in me still and came back to me easily. "Under the apple tree I awakened you. My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it." I isolated myself in my room, tucking my scrolls and my bowl beneath my bed. I would have to hold my breath and pray they would be protected until I could return to the cave and bury them. They did at least seem safer here than in Yaltha's room, where Shipra felt free to pry. Lavi brought me a bowl of grilled fish, lentils, and bread, but I couldn't eat. While I'd been out, Mother had hung my betrothal robe on a peg in my room, a white tunic of fine linen with purple bands in the style of Roman women. Judas would have been enraged to see me in such traitorous garb. And what of Nathaniel? Did my dress mean that he, like Antipas, was a Roman sympathizer? The thought of him precipitated a seizure of despair. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. Remembering that I'd tucked 3 sheets of clean papyrus into the goatskin pouch, I pulled the bundle from beneath the bed and removed a vial of ink, a pen, and 1 of the empty papyri. Having no lock on my door, I sat with my back braced against it to bar anyone entering and spread the sheet before me on the tiles. My writing board was ash now. I didn't know what I would write. Words engulfed me, torrents and floodwaters. I couldn't contain them, nor could I release them. But it wasn't words that surged through me, it was longing. It was love of him. I dipped my pen. When you love, you remember everything. The way his eyes rested on me for the first time, the yarns he held in the market, fluttering now in hidden places in my body, the sound of his voice on my skin, the thought of him like a diving bird in my belly. I loved others, Yaltha, Judas, my parents, God, Lavi, Tabitha, but not in this way, not with ache and sweetness and flame. Not more than I loved words. Jesus had put his hand to the latch, and I was flung open. I set it all down. I filled the papyrus. When the ink was dry, I rolled it up and slid it into the bundle beneath the bed. The air in the room felt dangerous. My writings could not remain in the house much longer. 16. At mid-afternoon, Mother strode into my room. She glanced toward my bed, where my bowl and writings were concealed, then away. She clicked her teeth at the sight of my betrothal dress in a crumpled pile on the floor. That she didn't chastise me should have forewarned me something awful was coming. "Dearest Anna," she said. Her voice dripped nectar. That, too, was an ominous sign. "Nathaniel's sister, Zophar, is here to see you." No one told me of a visit. "I thought it better to surprise you. You will treat her with deference, won't you?" The hairs on my neck debated whether to stand up. Why would I not? "She has come to inspect you for afflictions of the skin and other blemishes. You shouldn't worry, she'll be quick about it." I didn't know such an indignity was possible. "It's only to satisfy the contract," Mother went on. "Nathaniel must be given a guarantee by one of his own relatives that your body meets the terms he set forth." Blindness, lameness, afflictions of skin, infertility, lack of modesty, disobedience, or other repulsions. She eyed me with circumspection, waiting for my reaction. Insults caught in my throat. Obscenities I couldn't have dreamed of until Yaltha. I swallowed them. I could not risk losing my freedom to walk in the hills. "As you wish," I said. She didn't look entirely convinced. "You will submit gracefully?" I nodded. To inspect me as if I were donkey teeth. If I'd known of this, I could have given myself a brilliant red rash using gopher pitch. I could have washed my hair with garlic and onion juice. I could have presented her with any number of repulsions. The woman greeted me kindly, but without smiling. She was small, like her brother, with the same pouched eyes and vinegary face. I'd hoped Mother might leave us, but she posted herself beside my bed. "Remove your clothing," Zophar said. I hesitated, then drew my tunic over my head and stood before them in my undergarment. Zophar lifted my arms, bending close to study my skin as if it was some inscrutable piece of writing. She examined my face and neck, my knees and ankles, behind my ears and between my toes. "Now your undergarment," she said. I looked at her, then at Mother. "Please, I cannot." "Remove it," Mother said. The nectar had been sucked from her voice. I stood naked before them, sick with humiliation, while Zophar walked a circle around me, scrutinizing my backside, my breasts, the patch between my legs. Mother looked away. She at least did me that small courtesy. I bore my stare into the woman. "I wish you dead," I wish your brother dead.
What is this?
Zophyr inquired, pointing at the black dot of a mole on my nipple. It had been all but forgotten to me, but I wanted to bend and kiss it, this magnificent imperfection. I believe it to be leprosy, I told her. Her hand snapped back.
It's no such thing, Mother cried. It's nothing at all.
She looked at me. A dagger flew out of her eyes. I hurried to ameliorate her. Forgive me, I was trying to soothe my unease over my nakedness, that's all.
Dress yourself, Zophyr said. I will report to my brother that your body is acceptable.
Mother's sigh was like a squall of wind.
Dark came and the moon did not appear. I lay down but without sleep. I revisited all the things Yaltha had said about her marriage, how she'd rid herself of Rubel, and I felt hope leak back into me. Making certain to hear the plow of father's snores behind his door, I slipped down the stairs to his study, where I pilfered a pen, a vial of ink, and one of the small clay tablets he used for mundane correspondence. Tucking them into my sleeve, I hurried back to my room and closed the door. Yaltha had asked God to take Rubel's life if he must, as the just price for his cruelty, and he'd deserved his fate, but I wouldn't go so far as that. Death curses were common in Galilee, so prevalent it was a miracle the population had not died off entirely. But I didn't really wish Nathaniel dead. I only wanted him removed from my life. The tablet was no bigger than the palm of my hand. Its smallness forced me to shrink my letters, which caused the fervency inside them to strain at the ink. Let the powers above look with disfavor upon my betrothal. Visit a pestilence upon it. Let it be broken by whatever means God chooses. Unbind me from Nathaniel ben Hanania. May it be so. I tell you, there are times when words are so glad to be set free they laugh out loud and prance across their tablets and inside their scrolls. So it was with the words I wrote. They reveled till dawn.
17. I went in search of Lavi, hoping we might slip away quietly and return to the cave, but Mother had taken him off to the market. Posting myself on the balcony, I waited for their return. When I was a child, I sometimes woke from sleep knowing things before they occurred. Judas will take me to the aqueduct, Shipra will roast a lamb, Mother will suffer a headache, Father will bring me ink dyes from the palace, my tutor will be late. Shortly before Yaltha arrived, I woke certain that a stranger would come into our lives. These glimmers would manifest as I clambered up from the dregs of sleep. Before I opened my eyes, they were there, silent and pure and clear, like pieces of blown glass, and I would wait to see if they would happen. They always happened. Sometimes my presights were not about events, but snatches of an image that floated behind my eyes. Once a shofar appeared, and that same day we heard it being blown to announce the Festival of Weeks. I wasn't granted these mysteries often, and with the exception of Yaltha's arrival and the appearance of the ink dyes, they were revelations of the most mundane and useless kind. Why would I need to be informed of the meal Shipra cooked, or the delay of my tutor, or that a ram horn would be blown? There'd been no presentiment of my incantation bowl or my betrothal. I'd had no hint of Jesus, the burning of my writings, or the cave. For nearly a year I'd been free of these premonitions, and happily so. But as I waited there on the balcony, an image appeared in my mind, with vividness. A tongue, pink and grotesque. I shook my head to clear it away. Another inane visage, I told myself, but the strangeness of it disturbed me. When finally Mother returned, she looked flushed and excited. She sent Lavi to the storeroom, lugging a basket of vegetables, then swept past me into her quarters. I caught up with Lavi in the courtyard. Mother is out of sorts. He studied the ground, his hands, the crescents of dirt beneath his nails. Lavi? We came upon the girl who visits you. Tabitha? What about her? Please do not make me speak of it. Not to you, please. He took several steps backward, gauging my response, then fled. I hurried to Mother's room, fearing she would turn me away, but she allowed me in. She was white-faced. Lavi said you saw Tabitha. Has something happened?
She strode to her storage chest, the one into which Tabitha and I had pried, and for one irrational moment I wondered if Mother had simply discovered our interloping. She said, "I can't see how to avoid telling you. You will learn of it anyway. The city is already brimming with talk. Her poor father. Please, just tell me." I came upon Tabitha on the street near the synagogue. She was making a terrible commotion, wailing and tearing at her hair, crying out that one of Herod's soldiers had forced her to lie with him. I tried to comprehend. Forced her to lie? "Tabitha was raped," came a voice from behind us, and I turned to see Yalfa standing in the open doorway. "Must you use the vulgar term?" Mother said. She looked implacable standing there, arms crossed, morning shadows blossoming around her shoulders. Was this what mattered to her, the indelicacy of the word? A pressure started in my chest. I opened my mouth and heard a strange howl fill the room. My aunt came and placed her arms about me, and no one uttered a sound. Even Mother thought better than to reprimand me.
"I don't understand why,"
Mother interrupted. "Who can say why she stood on the street like that and cried out news of her defilement to every passerby? And she did so using the same crude word as your aunt. She bellowed the soldier's name and spit and swore curses in the vilest language." She'd misunderstood me. I wasn't wondering why Tabitha shouted her outrage on the street. I was glad she accused her rapist. What I didn't understand was why such horrors happened at all. Why did men inflict these atrocities? I wiped my face with my sleeve. Through my shock, I pictured Tabitha on the first day of her renewed visits when I'd been rude to her. "My father says my mind is weak and my tongue weaker," she'd told me then. It seemed now her tongue was not weak, but the fiercest part of her. Mother, however, was not done rebuking her. It wasn't enough that she made a show of cursing the soldier. She cursed her father for trying to seal her lips. She cursed those who passed by and closed their ears to her. She was distraught, and I'm sorry for her, but she shamed herself. She brought dishonor to her father and to her betrothed, who will surely divorce her now. The air crackled around Yalfa's head. "You are blind and stupid, Hadar." Mother, unused to being spoken to in that manner, narrowed her eyes and jutted out her chin. "The shame is not Tabitha's," Yalfa practically roared. "It belongs to the one who raped her." Mother hissed back. "A man is what he is. His lust can be greater than himself." "Then he should cut off his seed sacks and become a eunuch," Yalfa said. "Leave my quarters," Mother ordered, but Yalfa didn't budge. "Where is Tabitha now?" I asked. "I'll go to her." "You most certainly will not," Mother said. "Her father came and dragged her home. I forbid you to see her." The rest of the day unfolded with unbearable ordinariness. Mother kept me sequestered in her room while she and Shipra paraded out bolts of cloth, threads, and a ridiculous array of baubles for my dowry, and talked with endless banality about preparations for the betrothal ceremony. I could scarcely hear them for the screaming in my head. That night in my room, I lay atop the coverings on my bed and drew my knees up, fashioning myself into a little ball. Everything I knew about rape I'd learned from the scriptures. There was an unnamed concubine raped and murdered, and her body cut into pieces. There was Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, who was raped by Shechem. Tamar, the daughter of King David, raped by her half-brother. These women were among the ones I meant to write about one day. And now there was Tabitha, not a forgotten figure in a text, but a girl who sang while she plaited my hair. Who would avenge her? No one had avenged the unnamed concubine. Jacob did not seek vengeance on Shechem. King David did not punish his son. Fury welled in me until I could no longer keep myself small. I left my bed and crept to Yalfa's room. I lay down on the floor next to her sleeping mat. I didn't know if she was awake. I whispered, "Aunt?" She rolled on her side to face me. In the dark, her eyes gleamed bluish white. I said, "When morning comes, we must go and find Tabitha." 18. A servant, an old man with a deformed arm, met Yalfa, Lavi, and me at the gate. "My aunt and I have come to pay respects to Tabitha," I told him. He studied us. "Her mother has ordered that no one should see her." Yalfa spoke in a commanding voice. "Go and tell her mother this is the daughter of Matthias, head scribe to Herod Antipas, and the overseer of her husband. Tell her he would be offended if his daughter were refused." The servant shuffled back to the house and returned minutes later to open the gate. "Only the girl," he said. Yalfa nodded at me. "Lavi and I will wait for you here." Their house wasn't as splendid as ours, but like those of most palace officials, it had at least one upper room and two courtyards. Tabitha's mother, a large woman with a bulbous face, led me to a closed door at the back of the house. "My daughter is not well. You may visit her for only a few minutes," she said, and thankfully left me to enter alone. Turning the latch, I felt the drumbeat start in my chest. Tabitha huddled on a mat in the corner. At the sight of me, she turned her face to the wall. I stood there a moment, adjusting to the thick, dim light and the uncertainty of what to do. I went and sat beside her, hesitating before resting my hand on her arm. She faced me then, covering my hand with hers, and I saw that her right eye had disappeared into the swollen fold of her lid. Her lips were bruised purple and blue, and her jaw was puffed out as if stuffed with food. A bowl, a very fine gold one, sat beside her on the floor, glinting in the shadowy light, brimming with what looked like blood and spittle. A sob rose in my throat. "Oh, Tabitha." I pulled her head to my shoulder and smoothed her hair. I had nothing to offer her but my willingness to sit there while she endured her pain. "I'm here," I murmured. When she didn't speak, I sang her a familiar lullaby, for it was all I could think to do. "Sleep, little one. Night has come. Morning is far, but I am near." I sang it over and over, rocking her body with mine. When I ceased singing, she offered me a faint smile, and it was then I saw a ragged bit of cloth protruding oddly from the side of her mouth. Keeping her eyes fastened on mine, she reached up and pulled it slowly through her lips, a long, bloody strip of linen. There seemed no end to it. When it was fully disgorged, she lifted the bowl and spit into it. I felt a wave of revulsion, but I didn't flinch. "What has happened to your mouth?" She opened it so I could see inside. Her tongue, what was left of it, was a morass of raw, mutilated flesh. It writhed helpless in her mouth as she tried to form words, utterances that flailed about and made no sense. I stared at her, uncomprehending, before the truth hit me. Her tongue has been cut out. The tongue from my premonition. "Tabitha!" I cried. "Who did this?" "Fahr, Fahr." A dribble of red ran down her chin. "Are you trying to say father?" She grabbed my hand, nodding. I only remember getting to my feet, stunned and desperate. I don't remember screaming, but the door flew open and her mother was there, shaking me, telling me to stop. I tore away from her. "Don't lay your hands on me." Rage shredded my breath. It clawed straight through my chest. "What crime did your daughter commit to cause her father to cut her tongue from her mouth? Is it a sin to stand on the street and cry out one's anguish and beg for justice?" "She brought shame on her father and this house," her mother viciously exclaimed. "Her punishment is spoken of in scripture. The perverse tongue shall be cut out." "You have raped her all over again." I ground the words slowly through my teeth. Once, after father had upbraided Yalfa for her lack of meekness, she'd said to me, "Meekness. It isn't meekness I need. It's anger." I'd not forgotten this. I knelt beside my friend. The shine of the bowl caught my eye once again, and I knew what until that moment had been obscured. Getting to my feet, I picked up the bowl, careful not to spill the contents. I thundered at Tabitha's mother. "Where is your husband's study?" She frowned and did not answer. "Show me or I will find it myself." When she didn't move, Tabitha rose from her mat and led me to a small room. while her mother followed behind, shrieking at me to leave her house. His sanctum was furnished with a table, a bench, and two wooden shelves that were laden with his scribal possessions, shawls and hats, and, as I suspected, the three other golden bowls stolen from Antipas's palace. I looked at Tabitha. I would give her more than lullabies. I would give her my anger. I flung her blood across the walls, the table, the shawls and hats, Antipas's bowls, the scrolls, vials of ink, and clean parchments. I went about it with calm and measure. I could not punish her rapist or give back her voice, but I could do this one act of defiance, this small revenge, and because of it her father would know his brutality had not gone unwitnessed. He would at least suffer the rebuke of my anger. Tabitha's mother charged at me, but she was too late. The bowl was empty. "My husband will see you punished," she cried. "Do you think he won't go to your father? Tell him my father has been charged with finding the one who stole Herod Antipas's bowls. I would be pleased to inform father of the thief's identity." Her face slackened and the fight left her. She understood my threat. My father, I knew, would hear nothing of this. Because Tabitha had tried so hard to reveal what happened to her and been silenced for it, I removed the last two sheets of papyrus from the goatskin pouch beneath my bed and inscribed the story of her rape and the maiming of her tongue. Once again, I sat with my back against the door, knowing if mother were to come seeking me, I could not prevent her from entering for long. She would push her way in and find me writing, ransack my room and find my hidden scrolls. I pictured her reading them, the words of love and want that I'd written about Jesus, the blood I'd splashed on the walls in Tabitha's house. I risked everything, but I couldn't stop myself from writing her story. I filled both papyri. Grief and anger streamed from my fingers. The anger made me brave, and the grief made me sure. 19. The clearing where I'd seen Jesus praying was empty, the air spiky with shadows. I'd come early enough to perform my burial task before he appeared, stealing from the house before the sun hefted its red belly over the summit of the hills. Lavi carried the bundle of my scrolls, the clay tablet on which I'd written my curse, and a digging tool. I bore the incantation bowl beneath my coat. The thought that Jesus might return sent a shock of joy and fright through me. I couldn't say what I would do, whether I would speak to him or slip away as I'd done before. I waited at the cave opening while Lavi inspected it for bandits, snakes, and other menacing creatures. Finding none, he beckoned me inside, where it was cool and gloomy, speckled with bat droppings and pieces of stoneware, a few of which I gathered. Holding my headscarf over my nose to lessen the smell of animal dung and moldering earth, I found a spot near the back of the cave, beside a column of stone that I could easily recognize when it was time to reclaim my belongings. Lavi jabbed at the ground with the digging tool, opening a gash in the dirt. Dust flew. Cobwebs floated down to make nets on my shoulders. He grunted as he worked. He was slight, unused to heavy toil, but eventually he fashioned a cavity 2 cubits deep and 2 cubits wide. Lifting up the flax that draped the incantation bowl, I gazed inside it at my prayer, at the sketch I'd made of myself, the gray smudge, the red thread, then placed the bowl into the hole. Beside it I laid the bundle of scrolls, and last, the clay tablet. I wondered if I would see any of this ever again. I raked the dirt over them and spread the pebbles and bits of pottery I'd collected over the site to conceal that it had been disturbed. When we emerged into the sunlight, Lavi spread his cloak on the ground, and I sat looking toward the balsam grove. I drank from the wineskin in my pouch and nibbled a piece of bread. I waited past the second hour. I waited past the third. He did not come. 20. On the day Mother announced my betrothal ceremony would take place in 30 days, I'd sewn 30 ivory chips onto a swath of pale blue linen. Each day since, I'd cut one off. Now, alone on the roof of the house, I stared at the cloth, sobered by the meagerness of chips that remained. 8. It was the twilight hour. Moroseness didn't come easily to me. Anger did, yes, passion and stubbornness always, but sitting here I felt bereft. I had returned twice to Tabitha's house, but had been denied entry. Earlier today, Mother had informed me that my friend had been sent to live with relatives in the village of Jaffa, south of Nazareth. I was certain I would never see her again. I was afraid I would never see Jesus again either. I saw nothing but God's backside. Had it always been so? When I was 5, visiting the temple in Jerusalem for the first time, I'd attempted to follow Father and Judas up the circular steps through the Nicanor gate, when Mother yanked me back. Her hand clamped tight on my arm as I tried to twist free, my eyes straining after my brother, who moved toward the gleaming marble and gold gilt of the sanctuary where God lived, the Holy of Holies. She shook my shoulders to get my attention. Under penalty of death, you can go no further. I stared at the smoke plumes rising from the altar beyond the gate. But why can't I go, too? For years, whenever I recalled her answer, it would bestow on me the same jolt of surprise I'd felt the day she'd uttered it. Because, Anna, you are female. This is the court of women. We can go no further. In this manner, I discovered that God had relegated my sex to the outskirts of practically everything. Taking up the snipping knife, I sliced away another ivory chip from the cloth. 7. Eventually, I told Yaltha about Jesus, about the colorful threads draped over his fingers in the market stall, and how, but for them, I wouldn't know of him at all. I described the rough feel of his palm when he'd come to my aid, the sickening thud of his head on the tile when the soldier had shoved him. When I revealed how I came upon him again at the cave, as he prayed the Kaddish and the exigency I felt to speak to him, but stifled, she smiled. And now he inhabits your thoughts and inflames your heart. Yes. I didn't add that he caused heat and light to move about in my body as well, but I felt she knew that, too. I could not have borne Yaltha telling me that my longing for him only came from my despair over Nathaniel. It was true that Jesus had stepped into my path at the same moment the rest of my world collapsed. I suppose he was, in part, a consolation. She must have known it, but she refrained from saying it. Instead, she told me that I had traveled to a secret sky, the one beyond this one where the Queen of Heaven reigns, for Yahweh knew nothing of female matters of the heart. Footsteps jarred the ladder, and I turned to see Yaltha's head pop up like a fishing bob. She was agile enough, but I feared one evening she would topple off into the courtyard. I hurried to offer her my hand, but instead of taking it, she said in a low voice, "Hurry, you must come down. Judas is here." "Judas!" She hushed me and peered into the shadows below. Earlier, one of Antipas's soldiers, the vicious one, had been positioned close by at the back entrance to the house. "Your brother waits for you at the mikveh," she whispered. "Take care, no one sees you." I waited for her to descend, then followed, remembering Father shouting that if Judas were caught, Antipas would execute him. A thin blue darkness filled the courtyard. I didn't see the soldier, but he could be anywhere about. I heard Shipra somewhere nearby cleaning the brazier. Overhead, the windows in the upper rooms of the house stared down, narrow and flickering. Yaltha thrust a clay lamp and towel at me. "May the Lord cleanse you and make you pure," she said loudly for Shipra's benefit, then disappeared into the house. I wanted to fly across the courtyard and down the steps to my brother, but I clipped the wings in my feet and walked slowly. I sang aloud the song of purification. As I descended to the mikveh, I heard the heartbeat in the cistern, drip, 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 drip. The air in the small underground room felt thick in my throat. Lifting the lamp, I watched a skin of light form on the surface of the pool. I called in a quiet voice, "Judas." "I'm here." Turning, I saw him leaning against the wall behind me, the dark, handsome features, his quick smile. I set down the lamp and threw my arms about him. His woolen tunic smelled of sweat and horses. He was different, thinner, browned, a new smoldering in his eyes. Unexpectedly, my joy was overtaken by an upwell of anger. "How could you leave me here to fend for myself, without even saying goodbye?" "Little sister, you had Yaltha with you.
If she'd not been here, I wouldn't have left you. What I'm doing is larger than either of us. I'm doing this for God, for our people.
Father said Antipas will put you to death. His soldiers are looking for you.
What can I do, Anna? It's the fullness of time. The Romans have occupied our land for 77 years. Can't you see how auspicious that is? 77! That's God's holiest number. A sign to us the time has come.
Next he would tell me he was one of the 2 messiahs God had promised.
Judas had suffered from messianic fever since he was a boy, a condition that rose and fell according to Rome's brutalities. It afflicted almost everyone in Galilee, though I couldn't say I was much affected by it. The messiahs were prophesied, I couldn't dispute it. But did I really believe a priest, messiah of Aaron, and a king messiah of David would suddenly appear arm in arm and lead an army of angels that would save us from our oppressors and restore the throne to Israel? God could not be swayed to break a mere betrothal, and Judas would have me believe the Lord meant to defeat the might of Rome. There would be no dissuading my brother, though. I wouldn't try. I walked to the edge of the pool where his shadow floated on the water. I stood there staring at it. Finally, I said, "Much has happened since you left. They've betrothed me." "I know, it's why I've come." I couldn't think how he might have learned of my betrothal or why it would bring him here. Whatever the reason, it was important enough for him to risk being caught. "I came to warn you. Nathaniel ben Hananiah is a devil."
"You imperiled your life to tell me that? Do you think I don't know what a devil he is?"
"I don't think you do. The steward who manages Nathaniel's date grove is a sympathizer to our cause. He overheard certain things."
"The steward spies on Nathaniel for you?"
"Listen, I must speak quickly. There's more to your betrothal than what's written in the contract. There is one thing Father doesn't have, and we know it well."
"He owns no land," I said.
"Most everyone has a private torment, some voracious badger that gnaws at them without ceasing, and this was Father's. His own father had owned sizable papyrus fields in Egypt, and by law his brother, Haran, the firstborn, should have received a double portion, and he is single. But Haran, the same tormentor who had banished Yalfa to the Therapeuti, had secured a position for Father far away, here in the court of Antipas's father, King Herod. My father was only 18 then, too young and trusting to perceive the deceit. In his absence, Haran manipulated the law to take possession of Father's portion too. Just as it was with Jacob and Esau, a stolen birthright was the golden badger. Judas said, "Nathaniel went to him, offering a quarter measure of his estates."
"In exchange for me?"
He looked down. "No, little sister. Marriage to you wasn't a thought in either of their minds then. Nathaniel wanted a seat of power within the palace, and he was willing to give up large portions of his land for it. Already Father has promised him a place on the High Council, where he can leverage his power for the rich and keep his tax low. If that isn't enough, Father has pledged to rent Nathaniel's storehouses to hold Herod and Antipas's taxes and the Roman tributes collected throughout Galilee. This will make Nathaniel the richest man in Galilee other than Antipas. And in exchange, Father gets what he craves, the title that was stolen from him, landowner."
"What of me?"
"It was Father who made you part of their pact. I don't doubt our mother had been nagging him to find you a worthy betrothal, and suddenly here was Nathaniel. It must have seemed propitious to Father. Nathaniel had wealth, and because of their arrangement, he would soon possess all the clout of the governing class."
"Father!"
"I am sorry," he said. "There's no escape from my betrothal. The contract has been signed. The bride price is paid. It can't be ended except by divorce, and I've tried to affront him every way I could." I stopped, realizing it would never matter how repugnantly I behaved. Because of his agreement with Father, Nathaniel would never divorce me. I said, "Help me, Judas. Please do something. I cannot bear this marriage." He straightened. "I will give Nathaniel a reason to end the betrothal. I'll do what I can. I swear it," he said. "I must go. You should leave first and be sure the soldier I saw earlier is not in sight. I will leave by the gate at the back of the lower courtyard. If the way is clear, sing the song that was on your lips when you arrived."
"I must appear as if I've bathed," I said. "Turn your back so I can disrobe and immerse myself." Quickly, he said. Peeling away my tunic, I stepped into the coolness of the water, then dipped under, splintering his reflection into 1,000 black drops. Hurriedly, I dabbed myself half dry. God keep you, Judas, I said, as I mounted the steps. I went to the house, broken-hearted and singing. 21. One morning, 3 days after Judas's visit, I woke with the image of a date palm branch. Had I dreamed of it? I sat up, pillows tumbling. The frond was a twisted contortion of deformed green-black fingers. I couldn't get it out of my thoughts. The wind began to thrash about, and I knew the rains would come soon. The ladder thumped against the roof. The cooking griddles clattered in the courtyard. It was early still when an urgent and relentless pounding began on the front door. Slipping from my room onto the balcony, I peered over the railing and saw Father hurrying across the reception hall. Mother stepped onto the loggia beside me. The heavy bolt on the door lifted. The cedar door groaned, and Father said, "Nathaniel, what's all this commotion about?" Mother reeled toward me as if I were the reason he'd come. "Go and finish grooming your hair." I ignored her. If my betrothed wished to see me, I preferred to look my worst. Tromping into the atrium, Nathaniel looked defeated. He was hatless, his fine clothes soot-stained and bedraggled. His eyes darted about, irate. His whole countenance was such an astonishment that Mother gasped. Father traipsed after him. Nathaniel beckoned to someone behind him, and I had the feeling of something terrible looming. I felt like a bird waiting for the stone to fly from the slingshot. A man in worker's garb stepped into view. In his hands was the branch of a date palm. It was partially torched, dropping char onto the tiles. He tossed it at my father's feet. It landed in a clatter, a shower of black cinders. The smell of smoke wafted over the room. "Whatever this is, it is the workings of Judas." "My date palms have been maliciously burned," Nathaniel said. "Half of my grove set on fire. My olive trees survived only because I took care to put a man in the watchtower who raised the alarm in time." Father looked from the branch to Nathaniel. He said, "And you think it prudent to beat on my door and toss the evidence on my floor?" He seemed genuinely confounded by Nathaniel's anger. Nathaniel, this little man. His head didn't reach Father's jaw, but he stepped toward him, puffed up and righteous. He would tell Father now who was to blame, for I could see he knew. I pictured Judas's earnest face at the mikveh. "It was your son who set the torch," Nathaniel bellowed. "Judas and Simon Ben-Gioras and their brigands." "It cannot be Judas," Mother cried. And the men looked up, Nathaniel noticing me for the first time, and in that unguarded moment, even from this high distance, I saw his loathing for me. "Leave us," Father ordered, but of course we did not. We backed from the rail, listening. "Did you see him yourself? Are you certain it was Judas?" "I saw him with my own eyes as he laid waste to my trees. And if there was doubt of it, he cried out, 'Death to the rich and unscrupulous! Death to Herod Antipas! Death to Rome!' Then, raising his voice even louder, he shouted, 'I am Judas ben Matthias!'" I dared to creep to the edge of the balcony. Father had turned his back to Nathaniel and was attempting to gather himself. For women, the cruelest state is to be denied. For men, it's to be stricken with shame, and Father was awash in it. I felt a prick of sorrow for him. When he turned to Nathaniel, his face was a mask. He questioned Nathaniel about every detail. "How many men did you see? What hour did they come? Were they on horseback? Which way did they retreat?" As they spoke, Father's disgrace was set aside by rage. "There's a reason Judas went out of his way to declare himself your son," Nathaniel said. "He meant to put you in disfavor with Herod Antipas. If that happens, Matthias, if you lose your power with Antipas, you will be in no position to carry out our arrangement, and there will be no reason for me to go through with it." Had Nathaniel just put forth a threat to end the betrothal? Oh, Judas, how clever you are. Of course, Antipas would not tolerate Father's son waging these attacks. It would drive a wedge between them, making it impossible for Father to hold up his end of the bargain.
Judas is no son to me, Father said. He's not of my flesh, but adopted from my wife's family. From this day he is anathema to me. He is a stranger. If I must, I will declare it before Antipas himself.
I couldn't bring myself to look at Mother. I will see him punished, he went on. There are rumors that Simon and his men hide in Arbel Gorge. I will dispatch soldiers to scavenge every cleft and turn over every rock.
Standing beside Nathaniel, the worker who'd brought in the branch shifted nervously.
Let him be the spy Judas spoke of. Let him warn my brother.
Father had done a good job of pacifying Nathaniel.
Too good, I feared.
After he departed, Father withdrew to his study, and Mother dragged me into her room and closed the door.
Why would Judas commit this atrocious act? She cried. Why would he call out his name? Didn't he know doing so would antagonize Antipas against your father?